listening to
Is Sound a Language
on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is Aubriana Bench with WRCT Pittsburgh. This is the show Forbes Avenue. Today I'm joined by Colin Mockery and Asad Mekki. You guys may know Colin from his experience as an improv comedian on Whose Line Is It Anyways? Colin, I actually watched this show growing up all the time with my brothers.
I'm sure since you were a fetus, you heard it from the walls of the womb.
Yeah, I loved it so much. I got to say, you were my favorite. Don't tell Ryan or Wayne. Anyways. And then we have Asad Mekki, a world-renowned hypnotist who's performed for millions. And you guys have come together to create a show combining your expertise. So, I mean, I wanted to start with an easy question for you guys, which is, how are you guys? How do you feel about the upcoming tour?
It's good, and I think it's all places we haven't been before, so it's always nice to open up in virgin territory and show people exactly what the show is. So we're pretty excited. The show's a lot of fun, so we enjoy doing it, and we hope that that sort of excitement sort of carries on into the audience.
What other locations are you guys touring in other than Pittsburgh?
We're going to be going to Washington, D.C., all the way up to Fallsview, which is Niagara Falls in Canada. I mean, we've been doing the show pretty much nonstop for the last few years. We've done 200 cities across North America. We performed in Las Vegas and off-Broadway. So coming to Pittsburgh, looking forward to it.
Fantastic. I'm really interested how you two first met. Who approached who, and how did you work out the kinks of combining improv and hypnotism? I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but
I'll take that one, Colin. So I'm the master hypnotist on the show. I reached out to Colin through his website. His longtime manager, Jeff Andrews, got back in touch. In it, I outlined the concept of blending hypnosis and improv on stage together. And Jeff Andrews, my now partner and Colin's longtime manager, got back in touch and said, this looks like a really interesting idea. So we ended up throwing it up on the main stage of the Second City after the main stage show was completed, just kind of on a whim. And Colin was good enough to try it out with me. And let me tell you, the first show, it was very nerve-wracking. Because, and I don't really go into too much detail about it because, you know, a lot of these interviews are pretty short, but because we have got some time with you, I will tell you, I was so nervous because, you know, you're going up with an improv legend at the Second City, which is like a storied location and where all the greats have come out of as improvisers. And there's me pitching this idea. I'm not even sure if it's going to work. I don't know if I'm going to be embarrassed in front of the Second City crowd. And Colin was just like a consummate professional. He was just so calm and kind of reassuring and saying, you know what, let's give it a shot and see how it goes. But I will tell you, that first night was nerve-wracking for me.
Yeah, I've tried to find as many clips as I can online about what the show is all about, but what exactly goes down on stage, you know, how is it different from typical improv maybe, or what has stood out for you guys?
I'll take this question. So I'm the master hypnotist on the show. I bring up 20 volunteers. I hypnotize them, whittle it down to the best subjects, the most responsive subjects. And then Colin Mockery from Whose Line Is It Anyway improvises with the people on stage while they're hypnotized. So that is the main crux of the show. Colin comes out, improvises with these people. He's never met them before. We don't use plants, so we've not prearranged anything with anyone. They're just responding to the suggestions that I give to them. And Colin is creating an instant improv troupe with them, and absolute madness, chaos, hilarity ensues.
Have you found that people tend to be more willing to do stuff when they're under hypnosis?
So the part of the brain that deals with self-reflection becomes disconnected when somebody's hypnotized. So they no longer reflect on their behavior. They just carry out my suggestions without hesitation, without question. First-time improvisers, they'll play to the crowd. They'll look nervous. They'll hesitate. They'll use filler words. These people don't do that. They just jump in and they respond immediately to the suggestions that I give to them, and they're fully committed in the scenes. So it makes for really good improv.
Yeah. Colin, I know Whose Line always had super fast scenes for you. Has Hiprov changed your relationship with improv and like maybe made you slow down a bit or change how you work with doing improv?
Yes, in some ways it did, because you know, when I'm working with the Whose Line guys or when I'm working with other improvisers around the world with different companies, because we have the same sort of foundation and we're all working towards making a scene together and, you know, working towards an ending, it is kind of more fast paced and deliberate. Well, not deliberate, but with the people I'm working with, because I don't know them, I have to sort of actually slow down a bit and go, sort of back to my early days in improv where, okay, I'm focusing on this person. I'm listening to what they're saying, because also I can't go in with any prejudgment like, oh, this is a perfect setup I've just given them. They're going to take it and go here. They don't do that. They have their own. They just live in the moment we're in right now. They're not looking, oh, if we do this, we can end up in a rocket ship and fly off into space. That'll be the end of the scene. They're just keep going. And it makes it fun for me because I don't, as I say, I can't have any expectations. So I'm truly in the moment with them, truly improvising, going along with whatever they've come up with.
Yeah. So it's just so much more unpredictable than normal.
Oh, absolutely. There are times I think, okay, now we're done. We're finished. And then they'll add something where you go, oh, why did you do that? Now that's all right. But yeah, and every night we're just taken by surprise by people. And that's, I think, what makes it really exciting for us.
Yeah.
Really about to Colin's point, it's about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. It's these people who have no acting background, no improv background. They come up on stage, they join Colin, and the superstar of the show, because every night we find one, is battling wits with Colin. It's incredible to watch. I'm even dumbfounded at times and just completely caught off guard throughout the show, because they're giving such incredible, interesting offers, ideas, pushing the scene in different directions that you just wouldn't normally get. It's just, Colin often says words to the effect of, any trained improviser would never come up with that material. Any person who is trained in the art of improv would never have come up with it, because it's so off the wall and so odd and strange and out there.
So when you're hypnotizing these people, do you give them prompts that like prompts them to think along these lines, or does something happen that they're just like all of a sudden like proposing to Colin or like?
Yeah, so we get that. So there are games, there's formats.
Okay.
Wherein we have structure. So for example, let's say an old time Western where they're on the run because of something. So when you watch our Instagram clips, there's not that much context. So yeah. What are the questions coming from? So there's definitely format to it and game setup, but what occurs inside is all completely improvised, and we have no idea what they're going to say.
So it's kind of like set scene and then they run free, run wild, whatever.
It's exactly like Who's Line in that way. All right, you're two people out in outer space. Aliens are attacking. Go. It's just that easy.
It'd be so funny if you have, like, in Who's Line, where it was like the top-down camera, you have them like wiggling on the floor, trying to make it look like they're standing up straight.
We're bringing it in. We got to do it.
Yeah, let's get that going. Our budget is so big now.
That's for the multi-million dollar game show, Colin. We're putting that in. Those were some of the funniest scenes. The ones where they're doing martial arts, hysterical.
What do you think? What is both of your guys's like favorite thing that has happened on stage? Like immediate standout.
I mean, it's so hard because every night there's something, and there's something that either takes us by surprise or something. Sometimes it takes place after the show. There was this man who we did an improvised song together, and he was like James Brown. He was like killing it. He was rhyming, making sense, and he sounded amazing. After the show, see him with his family. His entire family is crying. They've never seen him sing, never heard him sing. He's very kind of self-effacing and kind of small. It was just, to me, that just kind of hit home that what Assad does with these people, unlocking the talents that they have that, for whatever reason, they're keeping hidden.
I think back to a scene, because we've been doing it for so long, 2016 Second City. Colin's doing a tap dance with one of the volunteers, and it's completely improvised and hysterical. I think about that when I think about just things that surprise me and catches me off guard. And the crowd was going absolutely bonkers.
I was 10 years younger, so it was easier. Now I just tap with a cane.
That's still dancing. That's so
good. Yeah, I think it is, as long as you're moving to music.
That's amazing that you can just, like, tap into people's hidden talents. And, you know, like, 5 years from now, you'll see them. They're going to be, like, an incredible dancer because they had never known a muscle.
Well, it's interesting because we've had people who have done the show. This one lady, she had crippling social anxiety, came up, didn't know why she wanted to volunteer. She volunteers. She becomes a superstar of the show. She's battling wits with Colin on stage. We interview her afterwards. She says, I don't know why I came up. I have crippling social anxiety, but I wanted to give it a shot. And she said, she said she'd been more free than she'd ever been before and that she wanted to explore improv. So I think there is something to it in that you're getting rid of the part of the brain that's saying, you can't do this, you're going to look stupid, you're going to look silly. All that kind of stuff just kind of floats away and they're just free up there. And it's really beautiful to watch. When they're in the zone, it's when I see Colin and we call them hiprovisers, the people who volunteered on stage that are improvising while hypnotized. When they're in the zone, it's like, it's magical on stage. It truly is. It sounds cheesy, but it is beautiful because you're seeing somebody on stage who doesn't have improv background, no acting experience. They're in front of 1,000 people and they're completely free. It's childlike and beautiful to watch.
So, like, how do you know if someone is hypnotizable or not?
Yeah, so I start with 20 volunteers, and approximately 20% of the population are going to be good subjects, hypnotic subjects for a stage hypnosis show. So from there, I whittle it down to the best 4 or 5, and then Colin comes out and then improvises with them. And I'm basing it on physiological feedback. So I'm looking for changes in rate and location of respiration. So breathing changes, skin color changes, you go light to dark, dark to light, vasodilation, the capillaries in the eyes become engorged, slow, sluggish movement, muted voice, mask-like facial expression. So they have a hypnotic mask. So they look like they have a poker face. So I'm looking for all of these physiological signs or indicators. And if I see them, then I'll keep the people on stage that are hypnotized. And then if I don't, then I'll just ask them to leave. And it's kind of like what poker players are looking for when they're trying to get a read, like an unconscious read on or a tell on their opponent. Same kind of thing. So I'm watching all of them very closely and then determining who's going to be the best candidates.
How long does this take? Do you think I'd be hypnotized over Zoom?
It takes about five to 10 minutes roughly. And it's very hard to determine until I'm in front of the person. And hypnosis is context driven too, because they've come up on stage, they've decided they want to be hypnotized. So a lot of the really good subjects, believe it or not, hypnotic subjects are already primed. So they already start to exhibit these trance indicators. So they start to look like their eyes start to defocus. They start to exhibit mask-like facial expression. They start to look kind of tranced out when they come up on stage. So they're already kind of primed. And if you pay attention, you can even notice when you talk to people, you can see when people start to go into trances because their eyes defocus. They start looking, they're not really looking at you, they're looking kind of through you, and they look like they're not paying attention. That's kind of what I'm looking for when I'm looking for a good subject on stage, somebody who's not paying attention. So, I'm saying this obviously tongue in cheek, but you kind of get a sense of it, yeah. Right? You sort of tell when people start to look like they're in another place.
Interesting. Colin, have you ever been hypnotized by
People keep pushing us to do it. So Asad hypnotized me, and it's incredibly relaxing. And, part of the fun of this show, I'm going to say fun. I don't know if that's the right word, but we have these two art forms that people are always doubting. All through the Who's Line years, I would have people say, I saw you reading cue cards. I was like, really? Okay, then transcribe that scene, read it back, and see if it makes any sense whatsoever. And it's the same with hypnosis. People, for whatever reason, just have a high level of skepticism. And that's what's great about this show, especially for family members or people who know the subjects. They are certainly seeing that it truly is something that works. And I hope it dispels a lot of the sort of the myths about hypnotism. Everything you see on movies and television tend not to be truly connected to the world. These people they haven't lost who they are. They're still the same people. They're aware the entire time. They just don't have that part of of their brain that says, you can't do this. You're going to embarrass yourself. They just have complete freedom.
Yeah. It's like people think someone's going to pull out a queen of hearts and something crazy is going to happen there.
We definitely are on the fun light side of the hypnosis, not on the clinical application. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say the people who are brought up are treated very safely. Asad is very careful with them, making sure that, they're in a safe spot and that everything is good. When I'm improvising, I'm trying to make sure that, as I would treat any improviser, so, we're not making fun of them, making them cluck like chickens or bark like dogs or doing anything embarrassing, have them take off their clothes. They're just your basic improv troupe that we're having fun with.
The old version, because there's people who are listening to this and have seen the, bark like a dog, cluck like a chicken hypnosis shows. That's not this show. For the crescendo of the show, I'll give you an example. Colin is a detective solving a case. He gets the information from the audience about what the case is about. He improvises the case completely on stage. And then one of the volunteers plays all the different characters that Colin comes into contact with while solving the case. So he might come into a contact with a femme fatale. He may come into contact with the chief of police, and they're changing and morphing into the different characters. So it's very much elevated. When we performed off Broadway, we were covered by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Out, New Yorker, and we were actually nominated by the Off-Broadway Alliance Awards for most unique theatrical experience. So it's very much theater.
Yeah. I read those articles, and I also found some like personal experiences that people were posting online and stuff. And it just really seemed like if someone wasn't uncomfortable, they were able to sit back down and eventually be guided out of the hypnotic state if they didn't want to be there.
Yeah,
And
you get stuck in hypnosis. So that's one thing a lot of people talk about is, oh, what would happen if, the hypnotist dropped dead, what mid show, right?
that would be
And
great.
they've done they've it was Dr. Orney that ran the experiments, and I believe it was Harvard. They hypnotized first year psychology students, turned off all the lights, left the lecture hall, 5 to 15 minutes, all of them would come out of the hypnosis, and that experiment's been replicated many times. You're not asleep when you're hypnotized, although the Greek god of sleep, fun fact, is named Hypnos, I should say. But you're not asleep when you're hypnotized. You're aware of what's going on. You're hearing the sound of my voice at all times. Physiologically, you look asleep, so because your body's really relaxed, but you are not asleep. So you're aware of what's happening at all times. You can't be made to do anything that you don't want to do when you're hypnotized. You can be made to do things that you normally wouldn't do. So that's the distinction for when it comes to stage hypnosis. And when people come up on stage, they have already given tacit permission. They are there to experience the hypnosis. And then they really do have these tremendous experiences. The best way to describe hypnosis would be watching a movie, getting so caught up in what you're watching that you're moved to a physiological response. So that would be the best way to describe a hypnotic trance state. So you watch a horror movie, you get caught up, your palms start to sweat, your heart starts to race. Logically, you know what you're watching on the big screen is not real, but for that moment in time, and during that scary scene, you think it's really real. Or you watch a tearjerker and you start to cry. Logically, you know that, the person who's on the big screen's not actually dying. It's not Leonardo DiCaprio going down with the ship. It's actually excuse me, it's not Jack going down. It's Leonardo DiCaprio who's acting, and he's dating models in Hollywood, making millions of dollars, right? So he's doing just fine. But for that moment in time, you're really, really, really so dialed in that you get that emotional response. So because you're so fully immersed in the movie. And that's the best way to describe what occurs up on stage when somebody's hypnotized.
because he could have fit on that door
Could have easily.
easily.
Just push her off, get on.
Oh, yeah, or that, like, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So kind of veering away, I'm curious if you guys have any tips for someone maybe wanting to get into improv, going. Like, because this is a totally different show, maybe taking a different approach, or would you want them to start out, just doing typical improv or?
I say to, first of all, if you're looking to do improv as a career, I always say, if there's anything else you love, do that instead. It's great. We were everyone on Whose Line, incredibly fortunate that the show came from Britain to showcase the one thing we do well. But I also say, to everyone, take improv classes. It is a great life skill to have, to learn how to listen to people, to learn how not to prejudge situations. And if you decide to do it as a profession, just keep doing it. And so many people who have started doing that have branched off into coming up with different ways of doing improv. Like Assad coming up with this particular brand. I have a friend who he started Dungeons and Dragons improv shows where the characters from Dungeons and Dragons, and there's a dungeon master who sort of guides them through an improv adventure. Then there's like one act plays that people have improvised based on a certain playwright like Shakespeare or Chekhov. So you can do so much with improv. Not only on stage, but in life. So I always encourage people to do it. It's a great skill.
What is the industry like the performance industry or touring or
Horrible.
comedy?
It's horrible. It's horrible. you know, there's a lot of people out there, incredibly talented people who, you know, either can't get a break, a lot of, and there's a lot of talented people who are working right now, showing, you know, we're lucky we've come up with this sort of, you know, I don't think there's any other improv hypnosis shows out there, so good on us. You have to find your place in there, but it's a hard business. It's a hard business because, you know, you can't show your resume and go, here's what I can do. I can, you know, I can, you know, build a house in 3 days. It's like, here, I make up stuff. It's pretty hard to find a job that, you know, fits. And, it, you know, you're based on your appearance a lot of the time. I know so many incredibly talented people who just haven't had that break yet. But, you know, when you're in this business, it's a business of dreams. And everything can change overnight. You can go from, you know, Wayne Brady was Tigger at Disney World. And then he got Who's Line. I don't think he went back to Tigger. It's worked out nicely for him.
Yeah. Crazy. How do you both see Hyprov, Hiprov?
Oh, man. Well, yeah, Assad has viciously berated people for less than that.
How do you both see Hiprov moving forward in the future? Do you think you'll add changes or maybe add people?
So I will tell you that we just sold Hiprov to a major Canadian streamer in Canada. We've licensed the show there. We shot a special. And now Canadian viewers can watch the show. I think the next step is to have it streaming in the United States. So that would be the next step, and then global, because we'd love to bring Hiprov to the masses.
Yeah. We'd also, it would be great if we could, you know, every country have a Hiprov with a local improviser, a local hypnotist speaking in their own language, doing whatever they do, and while we rake in the money. That's my dream. Assad, he's very, you know, he's noble and he has better, you know, he wants to make mankind better. I just want to add an addition to my house.
Are you guys doing anything in addition to Hiprov right now? Or is that like your both main focus right now?
We have an album out with Rufus Wainwright. It's entitled An Exploration of Hypnotic Sound. It actually features John Hilson, who is an incredible musician who plays improvised music with us throughout the show. He's our musical director, incredible keyboardist. So definitely someone to watch as well. His name is, again, John Hilson. He's part of the album.
Yeah, I do stuff. There's a TV show called Murdoch Mysteries. I think I'm a semi-regular as a serial killer, so I think I may be coming back for a bit. And then, something always pops. I just did I was out for my mother's 90th birthday in Vancouver, ended up doing a horror movie for a couple of days in the interior of BC, which was a lot of fun. Spoiler alert, I didn't make it.
No.
Yeah.
So first you were a serial killer.
And then I got my comeuppance in another project.
Yeah, and then you got serial killed.
That's karma.
Is there anything else you guys want to say to our audience before we sign off?
Sure. So I think the show is fast-paced. Hiprov is fast-paced. It's action-packed, high energy, and hilarious, because we've got Colin Mochrie from Whose Line Is Anyway improvising with people he's never met before who are hypnotized.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's family friendly. You have to be 18 or over to be hypnotized, but we have kids come to the show. They really enjoy it. They love seeing adults be goofy.
So the kids can't be hypnotized?
We just asked for 18 and up.
Apparently there's laws. Oh, well. So my idea of like 12-year-old butlers is no longer relevant.
It's been super great chatting with you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been really great. All right. Well, this has been Aubriana Bench with Colin Mockery and Asad Meki. Thank you guys again so much.
Thank you.
But yeah, your show, Hip-Rof, will be at Carnegie at Homestead, I believe.
I believe so.
On November 9th.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, we are on Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I have a guest here. So I've got Elizabeth Dietrich, who is a PhD student in literary and cultural studies. So one of your main things is studying early modern theater, so I wanted to start us off with a silly question. So what is your favorite Shakespearean insult?
There are some that are straight up insults, like Queen Margaret calling Richard III a toad, saying he's unfit for any place but hell, right? These are kind of straightforward, but I like the ones that are kind of shade in a conversation, sort of like the line, I do desire that we may be better strangers, which is from As You Like It, a very sort of funny, a lot of humor woven into that particular play. At one point in Hamlet, Polonius says to Hamlet that he's going to take his leave, and Hamlet says that there is no thing that he would more willingly part with than Polonius's company. So these are actually, I think, my favorites, are the sort of sly, situational, conversational insults.
So it's less you egg and more, you know, contextually, that is really brutal.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Let's take it back to more things you have done than random questions. But you've actually spent a while like working in professional theater companies. So can you tell me a little about what you did and what it was like?
Yeah, I've worked at a couple of professional theater companies. Haven't had the privilege of working with any in Pittsburgh yet. But I worked with the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, which is in Michigan, surprisingly, perhaps. And a professional theater in Chicago that is now closed called the American Theater Company. With the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, I had a double role as both a dramaturg and a company manager. And then in Chicago, I was in the education department. So a bit of a different sort of thing, less about putting the plays on and more about the outreach endeavors that particular theater did.
Before we go any further, I know a lot of people have asked me what a dramaturg is as an English student, and I don't really know. So can you kind of tell me what that's like?
Yeah. So my first answer is it kind of depends on not only the theater, but the play. It's a very flexible role. My professor of dramaturgy at my undergraduate institution said on the first day of dramaturgy class that the dramaturg is the smartest person in the room. Which is, of course, no shade to actors, directors, and all kinds of other brilliant people. But I think what he was going for is the dramaturg sees a picture that is sort of bigger and deeper than the others involved who might be focused on staging the play, on enacting one of the characters, or one of these sort of more focused roles. In my capacity as a dramaturg for the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, I did do a little bit of research, but a lot of that for that particular festival was also done by the directors. So I would occasionally look up sort of random questions that the actors might have. I remember doing a deep dive for the actress playing Viola in Twelfth Night, and she was sort of stuck on one of her lines. So she asked me, what does Viola mean when she says that her sister, or she's sort of impersonating Cesario, so she's talking about herself, but she's sort of in the third person, that this woman died of a green and yellow melancholy. So I did this sort of deep dive for this actress into early modern humors and bile, and we really got to sort of dig into, you know, is this a metaphorical sickness or a real sickness? So these kind of deep dive questions. But I also did a lot of promotional writing in the forms of newsletters, and I gave a public talk. So the dramaturg in some cases can be more public facing. but a lot of the time it's just a research role. And a lot of the time they have a very strong role in preparing the concept of the play, actually. Sometimes dramaturgs will do the background research that a director needs about the period that a play is set in or the concept of a play. And then sometimes they're also involved in new play development, finding new work for the theater to perform, or finding either new plays that are newly written or just finding plays that fit with the theater's sort of concept and their vision for their season. Yeah, so it depends on what people need. But in all cases, it's a research-heavy, writing-heavy job that can be very rewarding and teach you a lot of very random things that you never thought you would learn, like exactly what people ate in 1940, right before the Blitz in England or something like that.
Wow, that's
who knows? Yeah, yeah.
So about your role in Chicago, in more education, how does that fit into the whole idea of theater and what a theater does?
Yeah, that the mission of a lot of professional theaters will be outreach in terms of getting the community involved, whatever that community might be, and especially reaching out to young people who might not have theater accessible to them. So a lot of what we did was in the Chicago public high schools with teaching artists who were integrated into their classes. And then the students got to come to the theater and watch a special performance of the play. So it was an opportunity for kids who might not get a chance to do that or might not live conveniently close to a theater. A lot of educational programming is aimed at youth. Well, there's also a sense in which you do audience education as well, sort of writing things and making things available for the public to learn more.
I feel like that both of those roles are things that people wouldn't think of when thinking of somebody at a theater. You think of an actor, right? So what do you think people don't understand about professional theater companies from your experience?
I think you're right, and that people do envision theater as being artists in a certain sense of the word. I think everybody who works in theater sort of on some level considers themselves an artist, but they think about set designers and lighting designers and people who sew costumes in a basement or stage hands or something. But there's a lot of work that goes on, not behind the literal scenes, but behind the sort of figurative scenes of making a theater run. There's a lot of work that goes into getting money to help a theater run, from gifts from organizations to promoting at levels that might not be as obvious as your sort of social media marketing and things like that, but are more like community outreach, in a sense that theater really does provide, right, a resource for any community that it's in. And there are a lot of people who go into making that possible. So departments like outreach departments like marketing, dramaturgy is sometimes its own department. There's a lot of people who have day jobs at theaters so that you might not think. They're not sort of like treading the boards, so to speak, but they're more like doing spreadsheets. You need spreadsheets too at theaters.
I feel like you always need spreadsheets.
I'm a big fan of a spreadsheet. I love a spreadsheet.
Also, in working with different, theaters, do you feel like there are differences between companies? Are they regional? Is it just luck of the draw?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of difference between different sizes of theater companies. There are some regional differences as well, in large part because of communities, but also in terms of the sort of populations that you're trying to get to come to your theater and the sort of artists and professional population that you're sort of drawing from. So I've only worked in the Midwest, for example. I've never worked at a Broadway theater or even an off-Broadway theater or even an off-off-Broadway theater. nor have I ever worked on the West Coast, where things are a little bit, you know, you're in competition with a different kind of media out there in a large way. So, yeah, I do think that it is a little different. The pace might be a little different. Some of the risks that you're able to take in programming, if you're a very rural theater, then you might need to have sort of a more conventional approach to a season versus if you're in an urban center and you maybe can take a bit more risks and hope and still sell enough tickets to maintain your existence. So
a theater isn't just a community. The community does shape the theater.
I think so, yeah.
Obviously, you've done theater, but how is this different from like what you know about, and I assume you know a lot about, say, early modern theater?
Well, there are some surprising overlap, but I will say one of the biggest differences is, in some ways, theater is less valued now than it would have been in the early modern period. I think we could have a bit of a renaissance of our own, of really valuing theatrical practice and performance in society and culture and in America. You know, actors had a trade, and they're still, I mean, acting is still a very heavily unionized profession. It's still a trade, but it was really seen that way by the wider public, I think, in the early modern period. That at least is the impression I get from the primary source material. In the early modern period, it was probably more integrated into everyday life, which kind of goes hand in hand with what I was just saying about it being a bit more of a trade that you might expect someone to take up. When it's the only real media that you can consume, you're going to consume it more, probably. There is, of course, a very like popular book trade in even Shakespeare's day. People could buy books and even read plays, and they did a lot. But the idea of going to see or hear, as you sometimes hear people say, they're going to hear a play, was a bit more of a common occurrence and more just integrated into everyday life. And for that reason, had a more of a cultural resonance in everyday life. What happened on the stage bled out into wider culture more than it often happens with plays today. Some exceptions that might be a good way of thinking about how this happened is a show like Hamilton that everybody knows and is sort of like very commonplace in everyday life now.
People still quote Hamilton to me regularly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's very popular and very, it lives rent-free in the mind of many Americans, I think. And that's sort of, think about that, but with every play that's going on every day in early modern London.
Was it easier to put on plays then, or was it just because they could not go, they couldn't flip on the TV, they had to go see a play?
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps easier in the sense that you have a more captive audience for it. Mm. But on the other hand, the early modern period, we sort of think of it as a static early modern theater is one certain kind of thing, but they're innovating constantly, coming up with a new technology, a new way of doing something, a new way of even writing the play, a new method of performance, at least we think from what we can see in the plays. So easy in the sense that it might be sort of convenient, but not easy in the sense that they were sort of being maybe like complacent or lazy about it. They're really like pushing the envelope whenever possible. So kind of like challenging themselves, I think, is still what you could say that the early modern theater makers of their day were doing.
Yeah. So in terms of keeping pushing the envelope, you were telling me that you've also been looking into medieval theater. So how have they pushed the envelope since medieval theater?
Yeah, that's right. I would say that there is just less about medieval theater out there. And I am hesitant to in any way call myself a medievalist. But medieval theater, I'm really talking about the boundaries of the medieval era are sort of contested. But I'm really talking about theater before 1500 in England. And on the continent as well, but I know even less about that. So innovations that happened around the 1570s included like the playhouse, and things like that, which seems like it makes a nice, clean break between a drama that was maybe more itinerant, moved around, or ecclesiastical, happened in like church scenarios or at court or something like that, and was sort of religious or moral in nature. So it seems like we can draw kind of a line with the building of the first theater, called very creatively The Theater. But actually, there's a lot more continuity, I think, than a lot of the time is sort of acknowledged. I would say that the pushing the boundaries happens a lot more with pushing what is really working about medieval theater further. Having these characters who, the most popular characters on the medieval stage are the vice characters and the devils, because, like, who wants to watch an angel or a virtue? They're no fun. You want to see these devils scurrying around. So whereas you have a few devils in a play from the Middle Ages where they're sort of cajoling a human protagonist, on Shakespeare's stage, you push that even farther to a character like Aaron the Moor of Titus Andronicus, who's just evil kind of at his core. He resembles these characters, but he is almost the explosion of these characters as well.
That kind of brings me into something I wanted to ask you about, which is about how stereotypes, like, really developed in that theater, and in terms of, say, characters who are Moors or characters who are basically just evil and causing problems on purpose, and how that plays in.
Yes, thanks for that question. And this is what a lot of my research is currently looking at. And there are a lot of other folks who are also looking at this in the field right now. And it's hard to escape one's notice that Aaron, this evil character, is also racially inflected in being a Moorish character. It's hard to ignore that as being that overlap. And I would say that it is hard to say that it wasn't intentional. There are, of course, a lot of our cultural stereotypes about otherness are have their origins in this period of time. And the theater was a big part of that. So indeed, this idea that devils have a certain darkness that may in fact be visually legible in terms of their faces or the colors of their costumes, that translates into what is the beginnings of racial formation and thinking about something like blackness as being an actual category, despite the fact that phenotype is much more complicated than that. And so, yes, these are very much still with us to this day in the ways that the West deals with race and skin color and phenotype and things like that. Yeah.
Awesome. So as a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan. I have Elizabeth Dietrich here with me talking about early modern theater and theater today, honestly. I wanted to continue on that line. Obviously, these conceptions, these stereotypes have kind of followed throughout history. But I wanted to ask you how, like, the plays that may have shaped this, how have they been adapted throughout history to address this, or just in general?
The medieval plays?
Medieval or Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. There are still medieval dramas performed today, and I think if you go to see them, you will find that they are shockingly modern. They have these characters speaking very frankly. Often there needs to be a little massaging of the text to make it a little bit more grammatically understandable. But the issues that people are wrestling with are the same things that we still wrestle with today, you know, how to live a good life, how to take care of your community. So I think that they're surprisingly accessible, especially in performance when you have somebody actually acting it out. So in terms of Shakespeare, though, these are such well-known works, and even some of his contemporaries. I mean, Dr. Faustus is a very well-known play by Christopher Marlowe. People know these plays. They've read them in school. They're so familiar with them that when it comes time to adapt them, it's my personal belief that you need to have a really good reason for putting on, especially Shakespeare, because otherwise it sort of just becomes I kind of want to go out on a polemical limb and say lazy.
Don't do it just to do it.
Yeah, don't do it just to do it. You need a reason. But I think that there are a lot of good reasons. In some cases, it is because you may be in a community where students need to learn these plays for their educations, in which case I think that it's perfectly understandable to perform a play that is, for example, on a high school reading list to give the students an idea of what they're engaging with. But at a more sort of professional level, a new concept for a Shakespearean play, such as an interesting casting choice, especially in terms of giving maybe an actor who is from a marginalized group who hasn't gotten a chance maybe to be represented in such a visible and powerful way as in the Shakespearean lead, or if you're trying to respond perhaps to something going on in culture. That being said, there is an argument out there that certain plays shouldn't be performed. And this has some to do with their sort of origins in what I was describing earlier in terms of Titus, in terms of their origins of being marginalizing. I think the best example is Taming of the Shrew. I personally I can't fathom a reason to do Taming of the Shrew. I look forward to somebody proving me wrong. And this also has applied to Merchant of Venice for its anti-Semitic stereotypes. However, I saw a production of Merchant of Venice that changed my mind 2 years ago.
Tell me about that.
I saw the Globe, so in London, Shakespeare's Globe, put Merchant of Venice on in their small indoor playhouse. So the outdoor Globe is a reconstruction of the amphitheater playhouse, the outside playhouse where you can stand as a groundling or you can sit. But they also have another reconstruction space, which is a Jacobean playhouse, so from the early 17th century. And it's lit entirely with candles, and it's very intimate. And the late, great Adrian Schiller played Shylock. And Schiller is Jewish himself, or was Jewish himself. He sadly passed away recently. The dramaturgy, I think, that went into his playing of the role was pitch perfect. And the production left out the final scene of the play.
Oh.
So in some cases, you've got to adapt, right? In the final scene of Merchant of Venice, for those who are not familiar, there's a big party back at Portia, the great lady of the region, at her house. And it is the purpose of the scene seems to be to, first of all, exclude Shylock from Venetian society. He's already been forced to convert to Christianity and thereby lost everything he owns and his entire way of making a livelihood. In addition, this scene is exclusionary to his daughter, who has voluntarily converted. Instead of the final party scene that is pretty problematic, in this production, they had a sort of a reconciliation between Shylock and Jessica, his daughter, that sort of showed the audience what the play was doing in the scene that they didn't see, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It underlined what we can take away from Merchant of Venice, which may not have been what Shakespeare's audience took away from it. Unfortunately, they probably took away a lot of reinforced anti-Semitic tropes. But in this production, it really reinforced how one should consider Shylock's perspective.
So if you think that you shouldn't do Shakespeare just to do Shakespeare, what is your perspective on the people who do Shakespeare in like the most authentic way they possibly can, only casting men, making sure the costumes are pitch perfect? How does that play in?
Speaking of the Globe. I think it's an interesting idea. There are obviously some problems that you immediately run into. You listed one, which is that women did work in the early modern theater. Women's labor was crucial for the production of plays in early modernity. But it was very much a behind-the-scenes involvement. In the early modern period, no women appeared on stage. However, we have these great female characters. So, you know, kind of what gives? And it is an interesting, I think, exercise, not to mention research approach, to try to stage a play like Twelfth Night, for example, which may be the production you're thinking of, as was famously done at Shakespeare's Globe by the company there, starring Mark Rylance as Olivia, Johnny Flynn as Viola, and a perfectly classed Stephen Fry as Malvolio. It is an interesting exercise to see what the Olivia of Shakespeare's stage would have, could have, you know, with massive air quotes, should have looked like. It's just a research question and sort of a an interesting answer to that question. At the end of the day, though, that's just one other production of Twelfth Night and one other reading of it, so to speak. I think if you're going to do something like that, you know, you have to be making sure that your theater is inclusive in other ways. And I think that it should probably be the exception, not the norm, for productions. That said, I do enjoy that production.
I'm sure everybody asks you this all the time, but what would you say is the real value? Because we've been talking about how to study Shakespeare, how to deal with all these implications in Shakespeare. But what is the value of studying Shakespeare at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it depends on... I think it's individual. I think it depends on who you are. The value will change depending on what you are want to get out of it. Personally, I think that these are very dramaturgically interesting plays. There are a lot of people who disagree with me, and I love that opinion. I would love to hear them say more about it, because I love hearing reasons why we should be doing maybe newer plays. I think that's very valid. But for me, I think there's a lot of dramaturgical potential. And by dramaturgical potential, I mean they're very malleable in a way that a lot of contemporary theater tends not to be, because it's very situational. But in a way that sort of was baked into early modern drama. And so I think that to people who might say, well, we're doing Shakespeare too much, the answer is not don't do early modern drama. It's do Shakespeare's contemporaries as well, because there's a lot there that is sort of not as commonplace as Shakespeare's works. So the works of Marlowe, Jonson, Lilly, to go back a decade to a more obscure playwright, perhaps. Those folks are also doing really interesting things, often much more sort of avant-garde than Shakespeare even. And then in terms of the value of reading and studying, I think that it is a great tool for especially young people to sort of understand different perspectives, sort of the normal reasons that people say that everyone should read Shakespeare, but different perspectives, how language works, how poetry works, how to really craft a good insult in a conversation.
Absolutely.
to bring us back, all the way back. So I think that there is value. I do think that it should be balanced with other kinds of theater. You shouldn't just go see Shakespeare. You should also go see a brand new play. You should also see a play from the early 20th century. You should see a play in another language, even if you don't understand it. You should always go see theater.
Awesome. Well, this has been Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan. I've been talking with Elizabeth Dietrich about theater in the early modern era, now, even a bit of medieval stuff. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you for being here with us.